Oops. Are they yours as well?
So the context of my talk today is Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, where I was raised and where I was doing research the last few years. And in particular, I'm wanting to think about these two places that I have here, but more the places that you don't see that are below these images. So we have on your left the Vancouver Airport, which some of you may have flown through, and it's often celebrated as one of the best airports in the world for its kind of welcoming, multicultural environment. And then next to it here is our Vancouver Public Library, which is right in the heart of the city. And at the, on the rooftop, you can see this green space. It's a garden that's going to be designed for everyone, presumably. And I want to preempt the immediate question, which is, why Canada? I feel like this is an increasing question with the kind of Trumpism effect, right? Like, surely there's more important places to be thinking about questions of carceral geographies than Canada. But you know, what I guess one of the reasons I'm interested in taking us here today is it's not a numbers problem, right? The sheer numbers of detainees within Canada, although, as we all know, it's very difficult to quantify these, and they're often very obscure, to use a language from earlier. You know, Canada, the number of detainees is relatively small compared to other places. And in Vancouver, compared to the other two immigration holding cells, right, there's three in Canada, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver. Vancouver has the smallest number, and both of the immigration holding cells that I'm going to talk about today that are below these two sites are short-term holding cells. So both temporally and also kind of in the numbers game, Vancouver seems kind of insignificant. But it's this invisibilized subterranean dimension that I really want to think about today that I think is often overlooked. And I'm drawing here on geographers like Keith Addy, Steve Graham, Bruce Braun, among a few others who refer to this as the kind of horizontal bias within geography, that we are compelled to study across rather than vertically or below. And this, I guess I'm really interested because this isn't just an academic problem I see, but also one that really resonates with an activist mobilization and problematizations of carceral spaces. In Vancouver, I'm surprised how many people do not realize that these two very public, visible spaces have below them detention centers where people are being held in incredibly terrifying conditions and sometimes committing suicide, as the story will reveal that I discussed today. So I guess this is part of the problematic that I'm trying to think about is how little we know about what's below our feet, and that perhaps even when we do realize this, even the proximity with which we exist to these problems, we kind of become indifferent. And this kind of relates to some of the work Nick Gill's done on indifference, even in the face of such closeness to trauma. The other aspect of this case that I'm looking at is that these are not subterranean places that are sort of in the middle of nowhere, but right in the kind of beating heart of Vancouver. The airport isn't exactly the beating heart, but it is a hub of sorts, right? It's this airport space that brings us all together. It's a network space. It's not an island. It's not way out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm curious about this kind of the ways in which this immigration holding center is really at the center of things and celebrated as a tourist attraction still becomes obscure, right? And I'm particularly wanting to think about the spatial and psychic technologies, I suppose, that allow for such highly urbanized public spaces celebrated in multicultural language, right? And this is an image from Bill Reed's famous, he's an indigenous artist, it's called The Spirit of Hawaii, and it's supposed to, in a way, capture the way in which Canada has reckoned with the colonial past of many creatures together paddling, going presumably in one direction. And this image is sometimes used as an emblem of Canada's post-colonial context. So I guess for me, one of the things I want to think about is how are the ways in which the colonial present being erased, and the kind of cognitive dissonance maybe that happens where the hostile treatment of certain non-citizens lives too comfortably alongside, perhaps physically below, narratives of welcome. And I think Canada, in terms of this sort of strident narrative, is actually a really key example to look at. I'm going to focus by thinking about sort of the lived impact of this subterranean dimension, sort of drawing on work of feminist geographers, many who are in this room and at the conference today. I want to think about this sort of intimate impact that, particularly on the story of Sia, emanates. And I want to begin with her partial story. So Lucia lived and worked in Vancouver. She had fled Mexico, her country of origin, where she applied for refugee status in Canada, but was refused in 2011. She was afraid to return and to Mexico, so continued to live in Vancouver undocumented, like many do. She worked there as a hotel cleaner. On December 1st, 2013, she was taking a SkyTrain, which is our fast-paced transit. And during a, quote, routine check, the transit police, which is contracted out to a private company, a security company, asked for her papers. When she did not supply these papers, she was handed over to the border agency, CBSA. And she was eventually transferred to that holding cell below that lovely image that I showed there below our airport. In a shower stall inside of the cell, Lucia hung herself on December 20th, 2013, 3 years ago, almost to the day. And this was days before she was to be deported. She died 8 days later in hospital, and it was a month after her death that this news was made public. When her sister went to go pick up Lucia's remains, she was asked by CBSA to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So I want to pose the question, what can be said of this terrible loss, and also drawing on theorists of trauma like Jenny Edkins, what cannot be said, right? This is obviously a difficult ethical, problematic, and political question many of us face, right? It's troubling to make this kind of tragedy do work. So I want to situate myself here with, in relation to Lucia a little bit. I'm in touch with her sister and her community through some of my activist work with an organization called No One Is Illegal. This organization has sort of the belief that her story is very important to tell, partly to make visible that which has been rendered invisible, and to sort of challenge the ways in which this detention regime led to Lucia's death. So what does this story reveal? I want to kind of highlight these five aspects today in this talk. The first is that it obviously reveals a carceral landscape, one which we can sometimes overlook, a carceral colonial landscape. And maybe I shouldn't say landscape, but more of a subterranean scape, right? When we follow Lucia's journey, we are exposed to the ways in which this carceral aspect extends like capillaries or maybe circuits, right, through the urban fabric. And I think it's very important to take seriously this urban aspect of this regime. And the ways in which checkpoints are emerging within the city, right? She's in transit, and she's stopped by a private company, also reveals the privatization of this carceral regime. And finally, you know, this aspect of the subterranean space, and I want to finish by talking about how this is being resisted through sanctuary movements. So the first aspect, right? Just checking my time here. You know, obviously, I think that her story would be, challenges some of these narratives we have of Canada, right? Sometimes we kind of celebrate ourselves as the first to recognize gender-based persecution as a reason for granting refugee status. But you know, Lucia's claim was denied on the fact that Mexico is considered, you know, a safe place. So her story was very much one of domestic abuse. She was fearful of a domestic situation, and this was not considered to be a valid reason for her stay. So we're already kind of seeing these ways in which this story, this kind of general narrative of Canada is problematic, and is actually leading to vast irregularization, undocumented peoples who are facing all sorts of violence in their day-to-day. Again, you know, just to highlight this capillary aspect, this is our transit system, which looks all very nice and shiny from this kind of image. But the fact is that Vancouver is the only city where we have cops who are packing heat, right? They are actually standing there, armed guards, and they're asking for your papers sometimes. The reason Lucia was stopped was because she didn't sound Canadian. This came up later in a Freedom of Information Act that was done with, by no one as illegal. So this is a problematic infrastructure. We need to think about how the edge of the state is not at the edge, right? It's permeating into everyday life and into mobility, to touch on things from earlier, right? And the privatization, I suppose, of this landscape is also really important. And I highlight this also in relation to health, because the sanctuary movement, which I'll speak to briefly, has really highlighted the ways in which these checkpoints are actually creeping into these caring spaces where people are supposed to be getting treatment, where doctors are supposed to have a do no harm oath, right? These are places people are also being asked for their paperwork. So finally, this kind of subterranean culture, which I want to highlight. In one respect, we might think about this as a kind of archipelago, the island, right, that we actually were just hearing about, and it is an island, in a sense. This is called Sea Island, where the airport is, but it's the double spatial distancing and remoteness that I want to highlight, that this space of detention goes outwards and below. And what is the effect of this? I want to highlight just a few points. First, the fact that there's a basement that someone is put into with no windows, no access to daylight, has an effect of disorientation. And there's been a number of interviews that I did alongside No One's Leak with people who had been in the spaces and after were interviewed discussing, you know, this kind of incredible sense of disorientation and fear that comes from being so close yet so far away from people, knowing that right above you, there are people moving, getting to the places they, seeing the people they love, and you're just sort of trapped below, and the sense of helplessness that comes with that. This, obviously, the social and legal isolation also that comes with this. There's no access to lawyers, family, or community members. And then the temporal distancing, right? The fact that, again, Lucia's sister was unable to even know that she was there for almost a month and didn't even know about her death until after a month speaks to the ways in which these places become very insulated, spatially and temporally. So these features are very reminiscent of Foucault's carceral archipelago, which he speaks of at length, but I think that they're even compounded by this vertical dimension. And this is just an image from the YVR, again, just to show that kind of paradox of the ways in which the space is very much highlighted as connected. And this is, you can get photography done here for weddings, right, like engagement photos. They actually have this as part of a selling campaign. This is how beautiful this airport is. So this is one couple having a photo taken here. This kind of disconnect between the image and what's below the surface. And maybe what someone like Alison Mounts refers to as a kind of strategic visibility. It's not that this site is completely invisible. It's made visible to some and not in other ways. This is the other site I mentioned, and I just wanted to flag it up. I won't have a lot of time to go into detail, but very interesting to me, the kind of urban architecture that's being designed to pull our eyes upwards to these spaces, away from the street, away from the fact that this is one of the city's greatest amount of homelessness. Gentrification is at an all-time high. Homelessness is also way overrepresented by indigenous peoples, who we also know are overrepresented in our carceral system. So, I mean, I just find this very troubling, the way we seem to be moving up, 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 and forgetting that below this public library, which we're spending loads of money on, the kind of neoliberalization of this landscape, we are forgetting what's below. Now, I'm not gonna have a lot of time, unfortunately, to talk about the ways that this is being challenged, but this is where I've been spending a lot of my time. I've been very critical of sanctuary in my work, but in the last few years, I've been actually working very closely with a group who calls himself Sanctuary Health to challenge the ways in which this this kind of urban capillary crustal regime is working in the privatization of it and the kind of subterranean dimension of it. And they've been doing this through some really cheeky kind of determinant strategies, which I just love. They're just infinitely creative and always coming up with new ways of challenging this terrain. And I find it really interesting that they're using this language of from below. And they're doing so partly in the reaction to some of the failed attempts of sanctuary places like Toronto, or their perceived failed attempt of sanctuary movements in Toronto, where this was too easily co-opted by government. So I can speak more about this. I'm not going to have a lot of time. But just to say the ways in which, we talk a lot about how these strategies of carceral regimes are interwoven and how they travel, right? The policy traveling, but also these activist strategies, they're traveling too. And I find that really sort of hopeful, I suppose, not unproblematic, but these are just some of the sanctuary movements who have been challenging some of these landscapes. And I'm happy to sort of chat more about that in questions and on that time. So thank you.
Sorry, that was a very wonderful presentation. Also, because I'm also Canadian, so it helps to see it being represented. It's not really a question, it's more of a comment, because I can totally relate to this in the city that I'm from, because we just built, in Winnipeg, Canada, we just built the Canadian Museum of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. So talking about these landscapes and to say that we're always considering looking up, and the fact that the CMHR is built so that you are aesthetically looking up to the future, and that we're trying to represent all these different cultures and ethnicities and backgrounds, yet we're not considering the unceded territory of Indigenous people and of the struggles that they've gone through. And one of the issues with my city, Winnipeg, is that there is that neoliberal discourse that, well, that's in a where the Red River meets the Assiniboine. And so it's talking about, well, how can we make this area more focused on cooperation and on solidarity? And so all of a sudden businesses coming in saying, well, let's try to incorporate ways in which businesses and markets flood the area so that we can make it more of a tourist area. So I was wondering how you thought other cities in Canada, because it seems to be in those very hub cities that Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal seem to be working and fighting with this idea of sanctuary. I was wondering if that can relate to other cities in Canada, because it seems like Canada, for our feel-good representation of, well, let's encourage immigrants and migrants to come to our country. Do you see some issues with these ideas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. I think this resonates in other cities in Canada and also, you know, in other parts of the world. It's kind of very much this way in which we're incited to be urban.
Yeah.
Even the fact the airport, right? We're incited to move to be spending our money, capital flows, and all these things, but. The ways in which this flow is being halted in certain moments in those same cities. And I think that the example you gave is a really interesting one. I'll look into that too. The museum, was it?
Yeah, there's a series of scholars out of the University of Manitoba, Winnipeg, that just came out with an edited volume for the CMHR. So
okay.
I'd look into it.
Yeah, and just to follow up on the question of sanctuary, this is very much a translocal movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the UK, there's over 40 of in Canada, it's a question of how many are official sanctuary or sanctuary cities, but three official sanctuary cities. And what I find really interesting about Vancouver is the solidarity work, national solidarity with Indigenous peoples, and to challenge this notion that Canada is BC is one of the most unceded territories in the country. And this becomes a real problem when we think about these narratives of welcome.
Thanks for drawing attention. I hadn't actually thought of the kind of subterranean aspect of that imagery, actually, but
That's from Sanctuary Health in Vancouver. They passed a number of really interesting bylaws recently with the city council around refusing collaborations with police and transit, and they've done a lot of incredible work. I would have to find, I know the artist who did that, so I'll ask. I wish I had the answer if it was kind of intentional in that way, but
that's kind of the opposite of what you're saying in some way, like speaking to health and
I mean, this is one of the things I've been drawing on is the work of Bruce Braun as well, and he speaks about the ways in which colonial extraction and our resource industry is very much, you know, we need to think of that subterranean level, but he also speaks of the subterranean as a place of generation, generative politics, always has been, always will be, and I think that's a wonderful kind of symbol of that.
I'm going to have to stop. I'm really sorry.
No, you're right.
Thank you. But I'm sure I'll get